The holidays are already in full swing. The lights are up, you got good people, good food, and good vibes. And there to help keep that energy going is Sprite Winter Spice Cranberry. With that crisp cranberry flavor with a smooth winter spice twist. It's the drink that livens up game nights, gift exchanges, or just catching up in the kitchen with a burst of holiday flavor. It's a seasonal favorite, but it's only here for a limited time. So grab it while you can. Sprite Winter Spice Cranberry. Sprite. Obey your thirst.
Si usas la frase persona precavida vale por dos, the Colgate Total Active Prevention System is for you. Con una pasta dental reformulada, un cepillo de dientes innovador y un enjuague bucal antibacterial diseñados para trabajar juntos y ser 15 veces más eficaces al reducir el crecimiento de bacterias in just 6 weeks, starting from week one. Compared to a non-antibacterial fluoride toothpaste and flat trim toothbrush, helping you prevent oral health problems like cavities and gingivitis before they start. Cómpralo en shop.colgate.com/total and be dentist ready.
Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. I opened my morning newsletter, Morning Shots, by saying, look, we are seeing the transformation of the world order at an incredibly rapid pace. Yesterday, the president of Lithuania said deterrence is no longer enough. We need more defense. Putin will not stop in Ukraine. He will not stop. That is a stark warning. And it's one of those realities that most of us have not had to really think about for more than 40 years. And day by day, we see how the world order is changing. The Germans and the Danes are arming. Poland is home to more than 1 million Ukrainian refugees. And even with all of the frustrations and foobars, Vladimir Putin continues his campaign of annihilation. If there was any doubt in your mind that he planned for Ukraine what he has already pulled off in Chechnya, just watch what's happening. And you're seeing these images of Russian war crimes, and I think they're going to accelerate. This destruction of the illusion that many of us had that we had a stable and a moral world order. And of course, even as we're speaking this morning, by the time you listen to this, it will have already happened. President Biden has announced a ban on the importation of Russian oil into the U.S. This is remarkable. Also, a bipartisan movement in Congress, both Republicans and Democrats, saying it is, you know, it's enough. We are going to impose this ban on importing energy from Russia. I mean, that's really a headshot to the Russian economy. We'll see what eventually what the Europeans do. They won't necessarily follow suit. And of course, we'll see what the domestic political fallout from all of that is, because you have Republicans right now, and I don't mean to be too cynical. Well, yes, I do. Republicans right now, you know, urging President Biden to block the importation of Russian oil, but they will pivot in a nanosecond, of course, to politically exploiting the almost inevitable hike in gas prices that we're going to experience as a result of this. We talked about this on the podcast yesterday. This is one of the reasons why I think that Joe Biden needs to do something that he has not, I think, been terribly effective at, which is to use that bully pulpit to give a primetime address to the American people, explain what the stakes are, why we are doing this, and to lay out the sacrifices that it will require. There is no free lunch here. Before we get into today's show with our special guest, I just want to remind you of something that we talked about a little bit yesterday. The podcast will continue to be free. However, if you are a Bulwark Plus member, you will get this podcast and all of our other Bulwark podcasts ad-free. Again, we're doing this because we want to grow. We want to make this sustainable. We are adding staff, and we hope you appreciate the contributions that we have been making, and we appreciate your patience as we make this particular transition. So joining me today on the podcast, once again, is our good friend Kim Whaley, who's a law professor at the University of Baltimore, a contributor to Politico, The Atlantic, and The Bulwark. You are a busy person.
I am.
And because you have so much spare time, you have just published a new book, How to Think Like a Lawyer, and Why? A Common Sense Guide to Everyday Dilemmas. Okay, so we're going to have to double back on this, you know, because when I think of lawyers, I don't necessarily think of common sense. We'll double back.
I know, we have a bad reputation. We do have a bad reputation, Charlie.
Yes, but it's hard won.
Well, it's not black and white. That's kind of the point of the book. There's some good eggs and bad eggs out there.
Okay, speaking of bad eggs, can we start off by talking about Bill Barr? the former attorney general has a book to sell. And I wrote about him yesterday. Bill Barr has been doing the circuit and has been very critical of some of the things that his former boss did, but he is also justifying much of his own conduct as attorney general. And of course, this was the kicker yesterday. Yes, even though he acknowledges that Donald Trump was undermining democracy and lying to the American people, absolutely, he would vote for him in 2024. So let's start with Bill Barr's comments about January 6th. Then we'll get your comments on the other side, Kim. Stop the steal! Stop the
steal! January 6th, the riot. Do you think that President Trump was responsible for what happened here ultimately?
I do think he was responsible in the broad sense of that word, and that
broad.
It appears that part of the plan was to send this group up to the Hill. I think the whole idea was to intimidate Congress, and I think that that was wrong.
Well, that's good, right, Kim? He thinks that's wrong. Yeah, to send a mob up to intimidate Congress, that's bad.
Snaps for Bill Barr. We're moving in the right direction. Absolutely.
Yes, but slowly. So here is Bill Barr continuing. And, you know, lest we forget these things, lest we memory hole these things, Bill Barr became attorney general because Donald Trump thought that he would be his Roy Cohn. He had written that lengthy memo explaining how he would undermine the Mueller investigation. We all remember this, right? And then, of course, when the Mueller report came out, we had Bill Barr as the unreliable narrator with a press conference, a very short summary that mischaracterized the report, but really did frame much of the reaction. I mean, his handling of the Mueller report did turn out, I think, to be highly consequential. And he has no regrets. So here he is talking about his handling and his lying about the contents of the Mueller report.
This four-page letter, this summary, was immediately met with wide criticism that it didn't really accurately reflect what Mueller was saying.
That's not true. What it was a tantrum by the people who were hoping that Mueller would be able to bring down Trump.
Wait a minute. Mueller himself wrote you a letter complaining. He said the summary didn't capture the substance of his report and that there was now public confusion.
No, he didn't say the substance of his report.
Actually, he did. Mueller wrote Barr's letter did not fully capture the context, nature, and substance of this office's work and conclusions.
So, Kim, this is kind of a flashback reminding us who Bill Barr really was and what he is today. Your thoughts about that?
Yeah, I mean, when we see Lester Holt actually putting on the lawyer hat, I mean, cross-examining him, are you saying that Mueller himself, your longtime friend that in your confirmation hearing you said you have deep respect for, is throwing a temper tantrum because you basically distorted his months-long report? You know, Bill Barr is a master sort of wordsmither. I mean, this is sort of like maybe in the bad egg category of lawyers. He knows how to find the squishy stuff and the ambiguity and to gaslight and manipulate sort of in a way that he can't actually be caught at. But in this moment, as you point out, I mean, the word substance did actually appear in the document. So he wasn't very well prepped for that conversation. Listen, I mean, we talked about this, you know, at the time, many times, yes. Charlie. Mm-hmm. I mean, the fact that there, you know, his position seems to be, well, all I was doing was giving a bottom line like prosecutors do. And I couldn't release the entire report because there was confidential information in there. But Mueller helpfully gave us all a summary, right? So he could have just released the summary, number one. Number two, if you remember the timeline, he didn't have time to read the 400-page report between the time that he received it and he did his cute little four-page summary. The number three, let me add, is from a legal standpoint, and he just reiterated this with Lester Holt, that his conclusion was there's no collusion. Well, Charlie, there is no such thing as collusion under the law. The legal concept is conspiracy. And the fact that he sort of played footsie with that terminology, that was propaganda, that was PR, that was not a good faith lawyering. And there are other places where Bill Barr, you know, pushed the limits. For example, doing investigations into the election around the time of the election, right? That is a longstanding policy that the Department of Justice doesn't do. And we'll probably get into his, you know, his discussion mm-hmm. about with Trump, his reveal that Trump freaked out when he said he wasn't going to help him steal the election. But you know, for Bill Barr now to say, listen, I colored within the lines, you know, all I did was lawyer things. Unfortunately, that's not true. And he's alienating everybody because he's obviously alienating Trump supporters at the same time. You know, people that are watching carefully like you and me know this is a bunch of baloney, as my grandfather would say.
Do you know what I remember? It really struck me at the time. I can't remember who was interviewing him, but I think it was around this period of time. And he was asked, aren't you concerned about your legacy, how you will be remembered, what history will say about the role you have played? Do you remember what he said that? He said, no, I don't worry about it because we'll all be dead soon. I thought, really? And yet, apparently, you wouldn't write a book unless you were somewhat concerned about this, unless you wanted to, you know, explain yourself and you wanted to clean things up a little bit. But I remember thinking at the time, what an odd answer that was from him. Do you remember that?
I actually don't remember that. I don't remember that, Charlie. It's a little bit disturbing and nihilistic and et cetera, et cetera. Here's
my question. So he was willing to really lie about this report. And of course, as you point out, there's when he said no conclusion and exoneration, there was no exoneration and conclusion does not exist in the law, completely ignored what Mueller had found about the obstruction of justice. In the short run, I think we have to acknowledge it was a propaganda success. It was a political success, which says something, I think, about our media cycles and our political world. In the long run, I think we'll look back on this as a real blot on the rule of law and a real failure of our system of checks and balances. Do you agree?
I absolutely do, because we had three chances, we the people, to stop this kind of mudslide into something other than democracy. Number one was the first impeachment of Donald Trump, which of course involved Donald Trump's refusal to give President Zelensky authorized money to stop Russian aggression against Ukraine. And here we are in this bloody, heartbreaking civil war. That was actually number two. Number one was the Mueller report, which he basically killed Bill Barr single-handedly through propaganda. And number three was the second impeachment around the insurrection at the Capitol. And now we're seeing Trump-appointed judges dismiss, this just happened, I think, yesterday, dismiss a charge of obstruction of an official proceeding. So, you know, remember Mitch McConnell, after he voted to acquit Donald Trump on the second impeachment, said, well, the courts will handle this. There will be accountability through the courts. Well, he's also kind of by putting, you know, baby lawyers that don't have a lot of experience except for being in the federal society on the federal bench for life, we're seeing distortions on that end as well. And frankly, you know, that's a sleeping giant that is going to haunt us for many decades. And it's not just at the U.S. Supreme Court level. We're going to see these judges rewrite the law on the other end. And it's really devastating and it's very sad. And I should say, this isn't just the problem of the Republican Party. You know, Democrats, and I've written about this in the Bulwark at the time, could have done more, in my view, to push back and push back hard. For example, you know, moving the Chief Justice to actually call John Bolton as a witness. He's a mm-hmm, trial judge. Mm-hmm. Make a motion and make the Chief Justice rule on the motion, for example. They didn't do it.
So let me just double back on the whole Bill Barr not caring about his legacy thing, because I wanted to make sure that I remember this correctly. So he's on with CBS This Morning interview with Jan Crawford. This is from May of 2019. CBS's Jan Crawford asks Barr, when you came into this job, I mean, you had a good reputation on the right and the left. You're now someone who's accused of protecting the president, enabling the president, lying to Congress. Did you expect that coming in? There's a lot of sort of, you know, blah, 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 blah. And he said, it's all politics. He said, I'm at the end of my career. He was 69 years old. And then he says, everyone dies, and I'm not, you know, I don't believe in the Homeric idea that immortality comes by having odes sung about you over the centuries, you know. And apparently so. And Rudy Giuliani also said almost the exact same thing. He says, I don't care about my legacy, I'll be dead. So this was part of the culture here. So here's the question, Kim, though. He was willing to go along, do all of these things up until the election. And for a while, he did contribute, I think, to the big lie. But he reached a point where he decided, in his word, it was all bullshit. And he was willing to sit and tell the president that it was bullshit and that he shouldn't be pushing all of this out. And he did draw the line. Why did you think he drew the line there? There was no line until the big lie about the election.
I haven't thought about that much, but as I indicated earlier, I mean, you watch his congressional testimony when he was attorney general, and arguably he skirted the truth on multiple occasions in that regard. He's just very good at sort of taking a set of facts and reframing them in a way that allows for plausible deniability. I mean, frankly, that is how lawyers are trained in part, to sort of deal with squishy gray stuff and frame it in a way that's good for your client. I just, after 60 lawsuits were thrown out effectively in November or in December, not because these are pro-democracy judges or because these are Democratic judges, but because the way courts work is that there are rules. There's evidentiary rules, and you have to actually have a claim, a cause of action. I think he realized it was just too far out ahead that he could circle back and say, sit there like he's doing with Lester Holt and say, yeah, there was fraud in this election. I mean, I don't know. I can't climb inside Bill Barr's head, but what's stunning to me today in your newsletter, Charlie, is that he's saying he's going to vote for him again. I don't understand. I don't understand. Like, my brain isn't connecting those dots. Something's going haywire in my own brain. Maybe I'm missing a Bill
no,
Barr.
No. As Amanda Carpenter wrote today, this is your brain on broken partisanship or something. Let's play that, because this was really kind of extraordinary. For a few days, it looked like Bill Barr was saying, no, this is really terrible. This is really dismaying. He has said that he would oppose Trump's bid to get the Republican nomination. He has said that he would support someone else. He does not want to see Donald Trump back, which then led to this very revealing exchange with Samantha Guthrie.
You say in your book, it's time for the party to move on from Trump. Liz Cheney has said he is not fit to serve and should not be ever near the Oval Office again. Do you agree with that?
Well, I certainly have made it clear I don't think he should be our nominee, and I'm going to, you know, support somebody else for the nominee.
But if he is the nominee, and you have your choices, Donald Trump or whoever's running on the Democratic side, would you vote for him?
Because I believe that the greatest threat to the country is the progressive agenda being pushed by the Democratic Party, it's inconceivable to me that I wouldn't vote for the Republican nominee.
So even if he lied about the election and threatened democracy, as you write in your book,
it's
better than a Democrat.
It's hard to project what the facts are going to turn out to be 3 years hence. But as of now, it's hard for me to conceive that I wouldn't vote for the Republican nominee.
Wow. Okay. So once again, this is the power of partisanship, that no matter what you think about somebody, the other guy, the other side, is always worse. So in case there was any question about, is Bill Barr somehow going to rehabilitate himself? I don't think so, Kim.
No, it's really disheartening, because as we talk about many times, a hair's breadth away from the end of American democracy, what's happening across the country with voting and elections and et cetera. And on the Supreme Court, we can go on and on about that. And that's not hyperbole. I'm not the only one who's been sounding that alarm for a really long time. And it's too bad that in this moment, some of these old school Republicans can't see the forest for the trees and join people like Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger. And, you know, frankly, even Vice President Pence. I mean, he did the right thing on January 6th in the moment where there was a scaffolding being erected. I mean, I'm the person to say, give credit where credit's due. You know, let's give, you know, the treats and the snaps for people that are going in the right direction. It's just the fact that Bill Barr will still take that position. I mean, listen, I know we're going to get to this, but that's why I wrote this last book, How to Think Like a Lawyer, and why. Because you know, at some point you have to, Charlie, you know, there's an empowering element. I'm not a psychologist, but there's certainly an empowering element to being on a team. I have four kids, right? People like, you know, my girls like to be with their friends at school, at lunch. It makes them feel safe. And I think we're in that environment. You're on Team Red or Team Blue. But at the end of the day, you've got to live your life according to a value system. And, you know, we're seeing when degradation of democracy affects affects people in Ukraine, and that's it's a horrific situation. But Vladimir Putin is sort of has a worldview that he wants, you know, a single party rule, and so does what we call, quote, Republicans today. Mainstream Republicans are the same. And I just don't understand it, Charlie. I don't understand why these people can't adhere to their to some sense of integrity and humanity, and in this moment at least fess up to the fact that they maybe made mistakes. It's I don't get it.
I think at the moment it is unreasonable to establish a test that you have to say, I will vote for Joe Biden in 2024, right. But it is not unreasonable to say that you would withhold your vote from putting Donald Trump back in the White House. At a certain point, you go, no, this can't happen. And I am not, you know, going to vote for him. And I am urging the Republican Party not to, you know, put that cup in front of the American people. But I do think that, you know, if we want to have a coalition to demand support for affirmative support for whatever the Democrats do, just strikes me as imprudent and not a way to build the coalition. But that's my take. OK, so, Kim, I really wanted to get your take on something that happened. Was it last week? I've lost track of time. I think I've lost track of time for the last 4 years.
Makes two of us.
The January 6th committee's blockbuster brief that was filed in federal court that specifically said there was credible evidence that President Trump himself might have broken the law. Now, let's talk about the significance of this, because as you've pointed out, you know, Congress does not have the power to indict, prosecute, try, or secure a conviction for anyone ever, but this is still a BFD, isn't it?
It's a BFD because, you know, just to be clear for folks, there are a lot of lawyers that work for Congress, but not all of them were trained as federal prosecutors. The folks that are managing the January 6th committee are, you know, top tier former federal prosecutors, the best of the best. So they're developing this case as if they had something equivalent of a grand jury, right? It's not Congress collecting facts. It's prosecutors doing it in a very methodical, step-by-step way. And so for them to put in a federal filing before a federal court that here John Eastman can't hide behind the attorney-client privilege because the crime fraud exception would apply. That's basically how all of this came up. It was in kind of a mundane civil procedure type question. John Eastman, of course, the advisor to Donald Trump who wrote the famous squirrely two memos that walked through how to outmaneuver the Constitution, a former law professor at Chapman. He was let go or jointly resigned 13 days after the insurrection. He has a lot of emails and a lot of texts, and the emails are on the server of Chapman University. He doesn't own them. The January 6th committee asked Chapman for the information. He then intervened to say, no, Chapman, you shouldn't turn this over. And that's the fight now in the district court. And so they walk through how, listen, you can't claim privilege here because it's not even, these aren't even your emails, like all the basic fundamentals why he really can't not turn this over. He has no control over it to begin with. But then they get to the very end. They said, even if you overcome all of these hurdles, the fact that it wasn't confidential, that blows up any attorney-client privilege. The fact that there was no retainer agreement between Donald Trump and John Eastman, you weren't actually serving as his lawyer. At least that's not clear. You haven't produced any information supporting that. That blows through the attorney-client privilege. Even if we get through all of those hurdles, they're saying, we have evidence that there was a crime committed involving Donald Trump and John Eastman. And that's a big deal. That's not put in, as I said, in a filing like this, unless those former prosecutors are sure if push came to shove, they could prove it beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, you also know, I'm sure you heard, Charlie, yesterday, a Trump appointee federal judge dismissed a case challenging conspiracy to obstruct an official proceeding yesterday against one of the insurrectionists claiming that the rule of lenity or fairness to criminal defendants makes those charges not viable or not legal. We're going to see the very question of whether what was charged in this filing around attorney-client privilege, what was dismissed yesterday, that is going to go to the U.S. Supreme Court. And I think the problem here, Charlie, is we've never seen a January 6th. So we don't have laws that are tailor-made for that situation. This is how law gets made in America. You have new facts and you argue under existing law that these new facts qualify.
So the January 6th committee was arguing that Eastman is trying to use the quote-unquote bury the body argument for why the documents can't be released. What is that?
Yeah, so the crime fraud exception applies when essentially a client or a lawyer is trying to hide behind the confidentiality to commit a crime. So the classic example would be, as I said earlier, in order to have this privilege apply, you have to be in an attorney-client relationship. It has to be confidential, and it has to be for the purpose of legal advice. So if you're just talking to Aunt Millie at the dinner table, that's not privilege. So all those pieces have to be met. But even if they're met, okay, so say you hire someone, Charlie, he's your lawyer or she's your lawyer, it's all confidential. The legal advice you're asking is, where do I bury the body? That is obstruction of justice, right? That would be an accessory. So even that conversation, that comment does not get protected. The idea is we get to the bottom of crimes, even if you're committing a crime with a lawyer.
So you mentioned before that this document was written by some top-notch federal prosecutors and that they would not have put this in writing to a federal court unless they could back up their allegations, which suggests that they might be ready for a handoff to the Department of Justice. So what are your feelings right now on where the Department of Justice is and about the criticism of Attorney General Merrick Garland that he has been too laid back about this?
Yeah, I've discussed this with a number of other DOJ officials, including MSNBC's Glenn Kirshner, who's, you know, been critical for a long time about Barr. You know, it's impossible to know, obviously, Charlie, because we're not inside. My guess is this, and this is just the world according to Kim Whaley. First of all, it's really hard to have people in a grand jury at the same time you're having people testify before the January 6th committee, because you want to make sure there's a single narrative. And so there just could be complicating factors in having two ongoing investigations at the same time. So that's number one. Number two is, I really think this is about, in part, November. That is, Jamie Raskin has said, we're going to have hearings in April. It's going to blow the roof off the house, meaning we're going to get new information, Charlie. It's not going to be a redo of the trial on the second impeachment. And I think it's going to be educating people for the ballot box in November, not just relating to president, because of course, the president's not on the ballot, the members of Congress, Charlie, that were involved in this, right? That's the question. Should we keep these people in office when they were okay with this or they participated in it? I think that's critical. So I think it's kind of warming up potentially the American public to this idea of high-profile indictments. I don't think the fact that Garland hasn't done them yet means they're not coming. I'm guessing it might be just a strategic timing issue. That is, the center stage is the January 6th committee, that records being developed in a way as if it were within the Justice Department, that is by people that know how to build a case, an airtight case. So they're going to hand off a record that is, you know, DOJ is not going to be starting from scratch if they haven't already. And of course, even if the House of Representatives goes to the Republicans in November, the DOJ is still on the job. So they can kill the committee, but they can't kill what happens in the Justice Department. That's not all to say that, oh, this is great, we're going to see indictments. I think it's absolutely crucial that we see indictments. But I don't think we from the outside in can say that you know, we understand the strategy going on and it's a bad call.
Okay, so one last question on the Trump investigations. Over the last couple of weeks, we've learned about the what appears to be the complete collapse of the investigation into Trump and the Trump Organization by the new Manhattan district attorney who came in and then shut down the ongoing investigation. We learned about this when two of the top prosecutors resigned. It does appear that there are reports, including in the New York Times, that there had been doubts within that office earlier about the pace of that investigation. So this, give me your sense, put this in context, because a lot of people had been pinning a lot of hopes and expectations that the walls would be closing in on Donald Trump from the Manhattan DA, and that appears to be done. Is that correct? I mean, do you agree?
I think that's a fair reading of the tea leaves for a number of reasons. One is that normally, Charlie, when a criminal investigation is done with a grand jury, there's a bunch of grand jurors that just sit there for weeks on end and hear any case, any evidence involving various investigations or prosecutions. They just hear what the prosecutors need to put on that day. There is what's called a special grand jury that was impaneled just for the investigation into potential fraud, financial fraud and tax fraud into the Trump administration or the Trump organization. That expires in a couple of months. So this discrete group of people have heard all of this evidence. So they'd be the ones poised to indict. And their job is ending pretty soon. And to start over with new people is just not realistic. Number two, these two prosecutors are the ones that developed the case. And their resignation suggests that, you know, they thought they had a case. And of course, Cy Vance was pursuing it until he decided, the former Manhattan DA, he didn't run again. Alvin Bragg ran for that spot. He said when he took office that he was still going to look into this issue and that he was going to keep the top people. But then stuff sort of stalled. So I think, you know, you put two and two together and it looks like Alvin Bragg came in and for whatever reason decided to kill the investigation. You know, listen, Charlie, that's his prerogative as the top prosecutor in Manhattan. My guess, though, is, you know, he's an elected official. It's not like Merrick Garland, who's appointed by the president. At the local and state levels, oftentimes these are elected folks. I just wonder if Manhattanites would have put him in office knowing that that was coming around the pike. I think that would be surprising. And of course, you know, it's impossible to understand the dynamics. I mean, Donald Trump is a person that has been in Manhattan for many years and allegedly has crossed a lot of boundaries, right, that the rest of us adhere to. And so far, Teflon Don hasn't really had any serious accountability for that. So yes, it's over. That does not mean Letitia James's investigation is over, but she's at the state level and she's only civil. She's
attorney general.
She's not pursuing a criminal investigation. And then we've got the one in Georgia. And then we also have one in Westchester County that is a criminal investigation, but that's earlier. But the biggie, you're right. In Manhattan, I think it's dead.
Let's take a deep breath here. And I want to shift to your book, How to Think Like a Lawyer. And I want to approach it this way, that one of the things that I think is most frustrating in our culture has been the inability of people to think in a linear manner, to engage in fact-based, logic-based discussions. I think maybe social media has contributed to this, that the dunking has replaced actual argumentation. Now, I wouldn't have made this case a few years ago. I think I probably would have said, too many of us think like lawyers. We think in terms of litigation and, you know, and parsing. But I, you know, was this one of the reasons that you wrote your book, that in fact we need to get back to some sort of a shared way of argumentation, of thinking through complex issues?
Absolutely. It's a methodology. I think we're all a little bit overwhelmed, right? And so, I mean, it takes weeks and weeks and weeks in law school to teach students to not be looking for an answer and then just argue.
Right?
This is my answer. This is my position. And I'm going to argue for it. That's not what lawyers do. Lawyers actually look for questions. It's a very different mindset. And the way this came about, Charlie, is I was actually teaching a class during Trump's first impeachment when I was at CBS and debating Jonathan Turley from GW every day. Okay. The class was called Democracy at Risk. And we were dealing with really hard issues in class relating to the Constitution I sort of was tailoring it to the news. And what I asked the students to do is to come to class every day with two op-eds on whatever issue it was from competing positions, not the same one. And we also walked through how to find good information, because as you know, we're getting fed algorithms that adhere to our confirmation bias, right? The computer is telling us what we already believe.
Right. Correct.
But at the end of the semester, Charlie, these third-year law students said, this is the first time in my academic career I have felt okay to talk about hard stuff without feeling that I'm going to have to go on the defensive. That's when the light bulb went off, right? That, wait a minute, that as much as lawyers get this bad reputation, lawyers have to look at all the facts. They have to turn it, just like journalists, just like investigators in the criminal context. But you have to find the good, the bad, and the ugly, or you're going to lose. Right? And if the answer was obvious on Wikipedia, Charlie, why are people paying lawyers thousands of dollars an hour? The goal is to try to give people, and I have a 5-part sort of framework, a new tool set for walking through hard issues. And you might end up where you started.
Thinking skills, decision-making skills. This is what you're talking about.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Analytical decision-making skills that are based on facts. And I talk about how to find facts and based on a value system. You know, if you're really clear what your value system is, it's harder to be led astray. And I just think, you know, what's happening in Russia and, you know, what's stunning to me is the fact that these mothers in Russia reportedly are sending their sons in the battlefield in Ukraine, right? Thinking they're going to be welcomed as liberators based on the propaganda that Vladimir Putin is sending to the Russians that Ukraine is fascist and needs liberation, right? That same guy, Vladimir Putin, infiltrated American media in 2016, and that put Donald Trump into office. That's what blows my mind. It's like, wait a minute. We need to do this differently.
I mean, we are living in, and I actually wrote about this morning briefly, that New York Times story, how, you know, people are calling from Ukraine, they're trying to talk to their, you know, family members in Russia, and they don't even believe this is going on. You know, we are living in this post-truth world. And I think 5-6 years ago, we wouldn't have had a sense of how it works, except that it has infiltrated our culture. You do have this sort of thing here. So you understand it in a completely different way. So let me go through some of the tools that you're providing, because I think this is really helpful. I mean, you provide a framework and a methodology for how to approach hard problems. And I do think that people, you know, I don't know whether they're desperate for this, but they ought to be desperate for this. You have a 5-part system called breaking down. Well, why don't you walk us through this? There's 5 things. So number one, break down the problem.
Break down the problem. So take something out of the headlines. You know, should America send ground troops to Ukraine? I mean, that's a problem, right? But there's multiple sub-issues that, you know, a lawyer's mind would not deal with that massive, overwhelming question. There'd be sub-issues. And in your own life, do I take the job? There's going to be financial considerations. There might be considerations relating to your family. You break it down into smaller problems. You don't go after the biggie. That's B, break it down. I is identify your values. And I think people think of lawyers as, you know, kind of valueless, you know, sort of not people with integrity, but all laws, Charlie, have some value system behind it. You know, I mean, it wasn't until the end of the 1960s that there was a law that banned private companies from discriminating on the basis of race, for example. That's a value system that was put in to the law. And so I recommend that you identify on a piece of paper, what are your values in this moment? You know, is it moving through this conflict quickly? Is it, you know, taking care of your children's health, whatever it is. That's I. C is collect lots of information. And I do think we're in this problem in part because we need new skills to sort through the garbage. Whereas 20, 30 years ago, it was about finding good information. You had to go to the card catalog, like, you know, hunt and peck to find something. Remember the microfiche, right?
I do. Now, I do.
Remember that?
Yes.
Well, now we've got to sort and we're not being taught how to sort. Our kids aren't being taught how to sort. That's a new skill that I think the digital age has forced upon us, and we're just not ahead of that. A is to analyze both sides. You know, you have to see where the potholes are. You have to put your shoes in your opponent's shoes. We're really bad at that these days, Charlie. And then the T is to tolerate that you're not going to get everything, that it's not a black and white world. And what I argue is if you're clear about your value system, Charlie, then you can live with the fact that people are going to be mad at you, or not everyone's going to agree with you, or some on your team might criticize you. I mean, back to Bill Barr. This is what Bill Barr, he's trying to kind of have it all, right? And if you adhere to your integrity, granted, you're going to get people mad at you, but you always know you can sleep at night. You know that you can feel good about that decision. That's the T part.
So again, here are the 5 steps. Break down the problem, identify your values and your aim, collect a lot of knowledge, argue both sides of each point, and then finally tolerate the fact that some people will disagree with you and that you might feel conflict. Now, here's my question, though, that I can deal in that world. What I find frustrating is what we've called a bad faith argumentation, that you marshal the facts, you marshal the logic, and then you deal with folks who, frankly, are not interested in an exchange of ideas. They are merely interested in dunking. And that, I think, is particularly exhausting. So I guess I'm struggling to come up with the right analogy here. It's as if, you know, we have trained, you know, all year. You've gone to this boot camp, you've learned how to think, and you come out of the locker room ready to play a game of football, and you find out that it's lacrosse instead. And that's not a good analogy. reality, that none of the skills that you are applying work in some venues. Now, obviously, in a court of law, this is important. It is essential to do. But in much of our daily lives, if you honestly think that marshaling the facts and the reason and values is going to succeed, you're going to be disillusioned and disappointed.
Listen, I mean, you and I are both in the arena, right, Charlie? Right. I mean, I did C-SPAN on Sunday talking about the book and also talking about January 6th. And, you know, one caller called me a liar and I've had a lot of vitriol, phone calls, emails, and I was wiped out, frankly, for the rest of the day. Yeah. It is physically and emotionally exhausting. It's really hard. That being said, I have found, you know, I had my kids in Disney World a month or so ago, and there was an Uber driver who was very, very reactive, very kind of, you know, pro-Trump, to the point where I was almost uncomfortable. And I shifted right to values around, well, you know, how many politicians, Republican or Democrat, do you think, you know, have your back in the same way that your family does or your best friend does or your church leader does? That's where I shifted the conversation. That's, you know, my eye and bycat. And honestly, by the end of the ride, he was like offering to give me scuba diving lessons the next time I'm down there. And my girls walked out. They're like, Mom, he was kind of scary. I don't know what you did in there. And I'm not saying I'm some magician. And of course, you can't do it on TV with 30 seconds or even with an hour. But on a person by person basis, if we can start shifting how we think about these things and slow stuff down, acknowledge the uncertainty, try to find one point that we agree with. I don't know. Maybe we can model it person by person, Charlie. I mean, this is my sort of tiny attempt to try to move in that direction.
Well, we have to start somewhere. One last question. I understand that your grandparents were Ukrainian immigrants, and I just want to get your thoughts about this current moment and about the Ukrainian people, because I think a lot of people have just woken up and saying, wow, who are these Ukrainians? How did they get this way?
Really unbelievable, Charlie. I posted a couple pictures on my Instagram. Yeah, my grandmother is a first-generation American. The parents are from Galicia. They had 13 children. 7 of them survived. Dad came over first, I think, after the First World War, when one of the other, you know, sort of really high conflict situations in Ukraine where people were running for their lives. He, you know, started a farm in Pennsylvania. She came over, my great-grandmother, lost one child, buried him at sea. You know, they lived in poverty, no shoes in the summer. I mean, these are strong, strong, courageous people. I mean, I feel so honored to have that in my ancestry, but also, you know, it's been really heavy on my heart, like for a lot of people, you know, just the idea that, and I've talked about this publicly, listen, Charlie, you know, what we have to do to save our democracy is get good information and vote, right? We have to go over more hurdles. These moms and dads, I mean, they're having babies in bunkers. Like they're hanging onto their child's hands and crossing the borders into Poland. I mean, I just think this is a wake-up call for America. If we think that somehow we are in some elevated special status with sugar-coated democracy, we're wrong. So I'm feeling this very deeply. I've always had so much respect for my grandparents, who are both, you know, gone now, but the fact they always, Charlie, lived with integrity, and they had seventh grade educations. They were not fancy people. Maybe they didn't use all the right terminology that the left freaks out about these days. I'm sure they didn't. But that's my moral compass, and that's the light in the darkness. And it's really hit me hard. And I'm just sending as much positive energy as I can for those courageous people over there.
And the Ukrainians are not an easy people to demoralize or break, considering what their history has been like. And under Stalin, millions died during his engineered, manufactured, human-created famine. The Nazis killed millions more, and yet they're still there. So, I mean, if Vladimir Putin thinks, okay, I'm going to shell them and this will cause them to break down, then perhaps he's a little delusional about the history of the Ukrainian people.
Yeah, and think of the difference between what the crises America's gone through. We went through January 6th. We went through, you know, COVID. We were more divided afterwards, right? I mean, there was these tragedies and we went after each other. The Ukrainians are the opposite. You know, they are showing tremendous strength and love and solidarity and such devotion to their country and to each other. That's an unbelievable message in my mind, because let's face it, you know, Putin and Trump were buddy buddies. I'm no psychologist, but there's some sociopathy going on in there. This is something that we all have to deal with. But I think the message for Americans is it's we the people, right? Yeah. It's not we the politicians, we the Republicans, or we the Democrats. And the Ukrainians know that. And I think it's in their DNA somewhere. I mean, it's just amazing. It brings me to tears, I'll be honest.
It is a remarkable and inspiring story. Kim Whaley, a contributor to The Bulwark, Politico, The Atlantic, and her new book is How to Think Like a Lawyer and Why: A Common Sense Guide to Everyday Dilemmas. Kim, thank you so much for making time to come back on the podcast.
Thank you for having me, Charlie. It was terrific.
And thank you all for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We will be back tomorrow, and we'll do this all over again.
This is Matt Rogers from Las Culturistas with Matt Rogers and Bowen Yang.
This is Bowen Yang from Los Culturistas with Matt Rogers and Bowen Yang.
Hey, Bowen, it's gift season.
Ugh, stressing me out. Why are the people I love so hard to shop for?
Probably because they only make boring gift guides that are totally uninspired. Except for the guide we made.
In partnership with Marshalls, where premium gifts meet incredible value.
It's giving gifts! With categories like best gifts for the mom whose idea of a sensible walking shoe is a stiletto.
Or best gifts for me that were so thoughtful I really shouldn't have.
Check out the guide on Marshalls.com.
And gift the good stuff at Marshalls.
This time of year, most of us are checking off our holiday gift lists. But identity thieves have lists too, and your personal information might be on them. Protect your identity with LifeLock. LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second and alerts you to threats you could miss. If your identity is stolen, LifeLock will fix it, guaranteed, or your money back. Make this season about joy, not identity theft, with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year at LifeLock.com/iHeart. Terms apply.
At CVS, it matters that we're not just in your community, but that we're part of it. It matters that we're here for you when you need us, day or night. And we want everyone to feel welcomed and rewarded. It matters that CVS is here to fill your prescriptions and here to fill your craving for a tasty and, yeah, healthy snack. At CVS, we're proud to serve your community because we believe where you get your medicine matters. So visit us at CVS.com or just come by our store. We can't wait to meet you. Store hours vary by location.